Hey, welcome back. Today I'm talking with Jack Birkmeyer, former middle school English teacher, who is an author, speaker, trainer, and he is so very funny and inspirational, as well as completely engaging. You're going to love him. Today we're going to talk a little bit about all kinds of things dealing with the classroom, and we're also going to get into his book called Deliberate Optimism that he co-wrote with two others. Look for us to talk about relationships in the classroom and the importance of connecting with kids, as well as with your coworkers. And also look for us to talk about the importance of vocabulary in the classroom. You're going to love it today. Thanks for being here. Enjoy.
They're not here for us. We're here for them. That's what it's about. Kids.
Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is all about assisting classroom teachers and school administrators to overcome the many walls or barriers that kids face. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is focused on helping you help kids achieve their dreams. As a note, I hope that you will stop by Stitcher or iTunes and leave me a star rating and a comment. That helps the show get noticed by more people. Thanks for listening and joining me week after week.
Welcome to the Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 podcast, bringing you ideas and resources for K-12 classrooms, schools, and school districts. Hosted by Steve Mileto. And now, here's Steve with this week's show.
Hey, did you know that we're now available on Google Play Music? Check us out there. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12. Today I'm talking with Jack Birkmeyer. Jack Birkmeyer began his career as a middle school teacher in Denver, Colorado. After just 2 years of teaching, he was named as an outstanding educator at his school and then an outstanding educator in his school district. Jack is funny. No, really funny. You will have a difficult time keeping a straight face as he takes you through topics of professional development that touch home and your heart. He is focused on reminding all educators why they make a difference in the lives of children. Jack has presented in conference and school districts both nationally and internationally. Jack served as a judge for the Disney American Teacher Awards and the selection committee for the USA Today All-Teacher Team. Jack was also the assistant executive director for the National Middle School Association for 13 years and is the author of Managing the Madness, a practical guide to middle grade classrooms. He also co-authored HELP, for teachers. His most recent publications are Taming of the Team, How Great Teams Work Together, and Deliberate Optimism, Reclaiming the Joy in Education, co-authored with Dr. Debbie Silver and Judith Bainan. Jack is currently the owner and director of Nuts and Bolts, Ready to Lead, Teach and Learn Conference, located in Destin, Florida. He lives in Denver, Colorado, and I love this, has no pets or plants. Say hi to everyone, Jack.
How's everybody doing? Thank you so much for allowing me to do this.
Cool. I appreciate you being here. I got a chance to meet you a couple weeks ago at a conference in North Georgia, and you were awesome. You were amazing. And before I go there, because I'm going to talk a lot about that throughout our talk. So no plants or pets, huh?
Yeah, you know, it's really the joke is no pets, no plants, no people. I like the low maintenance of life. I like the idea that I can get on a plane at any time and go do what I need to do as far as work. Yeah, it'd be very tough. I would feel neglectful if I had a plant and it died on me. So I try not to have those emotional connections with things in my living space. I don't know, it sounds weird, but it's just kind of the life I've adopted, being on the road, working with schools. So.
Totally can understand that, but I love that. So thanks for explaining that. That's cool. So let's talk for a second, Jack. You taught middle school, and so what did you like most about teaching middle schoolers?
Well, you know, I mean, there's never the same day. I think that's what it's all about with middle school, is that you're not going to get the same day. You're not going to get the same day from your college. You're not going to get the same day from the students. It's just a pace that is so hard to describe. It's like running as fast as you can and hitting a wall and then realizing, why did I hit the wall? And I think I want to hit it again. I think it's that adrenaline rush that you get from being around young adolescents. And I think that if you don't have that calling to be around them, I think it's atrocious, because they are unique. They are not like high school kids. They're not like elementary kids. They are middle school kids. And they will suck the life out of you at times because they are demanding. They are ones that want attention. They want you to be around them. And if you don't want to be around them, I think your life would be miserable. So for me, it was just joyous. It was absolutely a great experience for me. I love the kids, love my colleagues. And I can't imagine me teaching anything else other than middle school. So for me, it was really who I was, and it was where I wanted to be.
That's excellent. That is excellent. Because, you know, it's funny, you hit the nail on the head with a couple of things. I taught high school history for 9 years, and I would have been fine teaching middle schoolers. I enjoy kids of all ages, but some of my colleagues would have said, no, middle school, not happening.
Yeah, and I'm okay with that. You know, I think there was a generation that when we came out in education, we took the first job that we were offered. And I don't think that's the case nowadays. I think that, you know, with certification issues, with not certification issues, not only just for content, but also for grade level, I think people are really starting to perfect what area they really want to go into. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. You know, I had a student teach in elementary. It was the most painful experience for me. It doesn't mean I didn't like elementary teachers or anything. It just was hard for me to relate to elementary kids. So for me, it was just a matter of, it was my calling, it was my destiny, it was where I was supposed to be.
Gotcha. And thank you so much. That's cool. And we need to have that calling. That's what's cool. Because you're right. There are a lot of people who they just ended up wherever they ended up. And it's neat to know that this is your calling to work with this age group kid. You know, I had the privilege to hear you talk at a conference recently. And I got to tell you, you're funny, you're poignant, you're passionate. I mean, those are three words that I would use to describe you. How would you describe you to other people?
Well, you know, it's funny because that's the work, Jack Berkmeyer. The personal Jack Berkmeyer is actually a true introvert, which no one ever believes. Because when they do see me present, I am, like you said, I tend to be loud and I'm crazy and obnoxious and funny and those kinds of things. But I kind of get my solitude actually from being alone and being quiet. I don't rejuvenate being in front of people. That doesn't kind of fill my soul. My soul is kind of filled by being quiet and introspective. I joke about it all the time. It's like I'm the worst person to sit by on a plane because I will not talk to you. I have no desire to talk to you. You know, people will say, you know, you're on a flight, you're going to Boise, and you know, and they go, are you going to Boise? And, you know, part of me, I want to say, no, I'm getting out halfway. You know, I'm just taking a seat. You know, I mean, I'm the guy that I just have no desire to kind of have those conversations. Not that I'm ever rude, because I don't like people that are rude, but I'm just kind of quiet and I'm kind of shy.
Gotcha.
And, but not in the work setting. It's just weird. And I know a lot of educators like that, which is kind of fascinating. They're great in front of kids, but they don't like to talk in front of adults. So I think that's what makes educators kind of unique.
That's neat. And by the way, I'm there with you. I'm the person who I can fall asleep in a heartbeat on a plane, and it drives me nuts when someone insists on talking to me because I want to go to sleep, man.
Yeah, I have headphones, and I don't even plug them into anything. And so, just I mean, seriously, I have created fake book covers to kind of shut down all conversation. My favorite one is you know, life outside of prison, how to adjust. You know, if you hold that up in front of somebody, it usually shuts down their conversation. Or, you know, another book cover could be, am I contagious? You know, or how not to snap in a confined area. All of these are good fake book titles that I wish they would produce on how to shut down the chatty talker.
So those are awesome.
Maybe I should do that. I might market that.
Yeah, that's an awesome idea right there. I think you'd have some buyers for that one.
Exactly.
That's incredible. I love those titles. Yes, those would definitely keep people away.
Yeah, that definitely might keep people away. That's
yes, I
true.
Gotcha. Would you agree that, speaking of humor, would you agree that teaching requires a sense of humor? And not necessarily that you have to be funny, but that the adult needs to not get upset about everything. And if so, why do you think it's important?
Yeah, the biggest compliment I get, which is actually the saddest compliment, is teachers will come up. These are veteran teachers. These are teachers who have been in the trenches, who have gone through every fad and fashion and trend in education, and you know, have just seen everything remarketed and redistributed, and they will literally come up and they'll say, you know, thanks for making me laugh. And it actually makes me sad because I'm like, you know, school is funny. You know, education is funny, and there is nothing wrong with us, you know, remembering the fact that school should be a place of humor and should be a place of fun and laughter. And I think, unfortunately, because of the shield of standards that we have nowadays, I think teachers have kind of retreated from that essence of humor and that essence of fun. And so for me, I'm trying to rebuild that and say, you know, if you're laughing, if you're having a good time, you build those endorphins. When you build those endorphins, makes you a better person. It makes kids like school. I feel bad for kids nowadays going to school. And I feel bad for teachers in PD sessions, too. So in PD, I think in professional development, I really think that we're almost afraid. I think we want to go in and say, okay, here's what you need to know and here's what you need to change. Well, people aren't going to change if you do that to them. You've got to make them feel comfortable. You've got to make them laugh, and you got to make them feel good. I guess the best analogy, and I'll give you this. When I was a teacher and I was sitting in the back row with my language arts papers debating whether to grade or listen to the presenter or do what I, you know, do something I probably shouldn't have been doing, I remember listening one time to a speaker and I said, you know, if I ever do this, if I ever teach teachers, I want three things. One, I want a sense of humor from the presenter. Two, I want something practical. And three, I want the reasons why. I want the philosophical reasons why. And I think that's how I've always gone into professional development. I'm going to make you laugh. I'm going to give you something you can use. And I'm going to give you the reason why. And I think if you balance that as a presenter, I think you get teachers buy-in a lot quicker.
That's excellent. I love that. And I saw you do that, too. That's, you know, you sucked us right in with all of that. And that's so cool. And you know,
I call myself the master of manipulation is what it is. It's, you know.
Nice. You know, having been a principal in buildings where I was hired to make change, to do change. And, you know, it is one of those things where that back row, you know, you always had to move the back row forward. You know,
say
no one sits past this area.
Hey, you know, and in today's day and age, I firmly believe that we have to make our colleagues a little professionally uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I know that may seem harsh, but I firmly believe that, which is, wait a minute, you know, you got to step it up. You know, you got to be willing to take in that professional development. You got to be willing to take those risks and step up and present. I really am an advocate of teachers teaching teachers. I think that's the most powerful form of professional development.
You know, one of the things that working with kids and working with teachers, working with kids and professional development, one of the things I do is I spend some time with teachers who struggle a little bit, and I go watch them teach. And since I'm not their evaluator, you know, they can either just kind of say, oh, nice man, you think I'm going to listen to you, or they can you know, talk with me and I'll be happy to help them. And one of the things that I find a lot of times is that some of the people who struggle, one of the problems they have is they struggle with actually figuring out how to get the kids interested in the content and engaged in the content. What sort of advice would you give to a teacher who's struggling in that area?
You know, I think the advice I give, and I mentioned it a little earlier, is, and it's from my very good friend, Rick Warmly. And Rick says this, you know, we've got to stop using the shield of standards to no longer be creative. And I think that's the crutch we have now, which is this, oh, I can't do those things. I can't do those fun things. I can't do those engagement things because, you know, those aren't part of the assessment or those aren't part of the test. Well, that's a lie. You know, I mean, it's about content and it's about teaching the content. When the kids have the content, then they will do fine on the assessments or the tests. So for me, about that student engagement piece is that not only do I think we use the shield of standards, but I think we're the biggest barrier in that creativity. You know, I am the guy that will get on the desk and scream and shout and do chants and those kinds of things. And I know I have colleagues that won't do that or couldn't do that. That just shows right there that there's a barrier. I think the best example I've ever seen was I was at a K-8 school. And I went from, you know, a kindergarten class where they're on the floor and they're, you know, they're learning about their letters. And then second grade, I go in there and they're singing a song about something that they're learning. And then I go to fourth grade and there's the overhead. The kids are in the rows and they're doing sit and get. And I'm like, how do we go from 3 or 4 years of singing and dancing and playing to sitting and getting? And I'm like, I think that has a lot to do with teachers' inhibitions to be a little bit more bold and to be a little more courageous in that classroom. Student engagement is, to me, means Are you engaged? Are you willing to do some of those things? And if you're not, then I bet your students aren't either.
That's awesome, because that's, you know, that typically is it too. If they're not engaged, the kids aren't going to be. I mean, you just hit the nail on the head, man. You see that a lot. You're just like, well, maybe you need to go reconnect with life and then come back and teach again. So, but I so agree with that. Well, let's use that as kind of a segue into the book, Deliberate Optimism: Reclaiming the Joy in Education. And what I'd like to do is in chapter one, you include this in its opening, and it says, when individuals decide to become teachers, they enter an unbreakable pact with the future. Can you tell us what this means?
Yeah. And first of all, I have to give all credit where credit is due when I talk about deliberate optimism, reclaiming the joy in education. All credit goes to my co-authors, especially Debbie Silver, who was phenomenal in roping the two of us together to get this book to happen. And the other is Judith Bannon. And first of all, they're two of my best friends in education, so I think that kind of was wonderful. But I think it's tough that when three leading educators have to sit down and write a book about deliberate optimism, reclaiming the joy in education, I think that's sad. I think that's a sad state of affairs where we have to write a book about reclaiming the joy and being deliberate in our optimism. And we were adamant about that title because I think in today's day and age, you have to be deliberate in your optimism. You have to literally choose to be optimistic. You have to say, this is where teaching is where I want to be. It's what I want to do. And I'm going to make that commitment. And I think that's where that first chapter ties in, which is that whole essence of becoming a teacher was a choice for me. I knew it. I knew it early on. That's not the path for everyone in education. Some people take different paths into education. For me, it was at a young age. For others, it's not. So I just want to make sure that people are deliberately optimistic because of all those outside influences that are negative about education. We're the only ones that can remain optimistic about it. So I think I just needed to kind of give that preface about why that is so important about the title and why it's so important that we chose to write a book about it.
Oh, I think that's awesome because it is sad because there is a, you know, one of the things that I do get into, I mean, you can't do much without, you can't be alive without noticing that there is a focus from one realm of the world on teachers. Anybody can teach. Oh yeah, we don't need teachers. We can get a computer to do it, or we can get this to do it, or we can, and matter of fact, we can replace them with all kinds of stuff, and we'll pull away the money, and we'll do all this other stuff, and it's real easy just to attack that. And then on the other side, you got them going, I got to figure out how to work with the kids, and I'm going to do all this stuff, and we're going to have fun, and we're going to learn, and we're going to do all this, and what happens though is that after a while, some of that outside influence starts wearing on their shoulders, and you do see it, and so that idea of optimism, I think, is important to remind them, and that's why they do need the opportunity to be with somebody like you, where you know you get them excited about you inspire them and get them feeling good again, and I think that's so right, and I appreciate you explaining that title. By the way, I think it's neat what you said about working with two other educators and, you know, putting together a team to write a book. That in itself has to be an experience, I can imagine.
Oh, it is. And we started here in Denver together. And we were really going down a different path and talking about something else. And then it just kind of came together. And it was like, it was just a weird experience. I wish we probably should have videotaped it, because the way we envisioned starting that book was not how we ended up. And it was kind of a fascinating journey of just educators learning from each other and actually talking about what is it we really want to provide for educators. And so it was kind of a unique experience, if nothing else.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, let's look at another part of the book, because and I'm going to go to two more chapters. In chapter four, there's a section, it's called Building Healthy Relationships and an Optimistic Shared Community. And this stands out. And it's this line: forming positive relationships with the various collaborators in the building makes the workplace more enjoyable and gives us energy we need to face the continuing pressures of being a teacher. Can you talk a little bit about that, about forming those positive relationships with our colleagues?
You know, and this is nothing new. You know, that comment and that statement has been preached, has been shouted from the mountaintop for years about you have to build collaborations, you have to work with each other. But I think also the way we were trying to emphasize this is that's hard to do. It's hard when you have the naysayers. It's hard when you have the people that will come in and suck the life out of you. And by the way, I'm not talking about outside. I'm talking about internal educators, those educators who, to quote a good friend of mine, Neela Connors, she does a great line. She says, there are some people that if you gave them a $20 bill, they'd still want $210. And you're like, you know, and it's like, come on, nothing is going to make you happy. But yet we focus on those people when in actuality, we should be building those collaborators and people who are like-minded like us, people who are progressive and want to do well in education. And those should be our surrounding people, not those 5%. And I use this a lot in my speech, and I think it relates to staff, and I think it relates to students. I'm tired of spending 95% of our time on 5% of either students or teachers who are sucking the life out of us. That is just not fair to the rest of everybody, but yet that's our focal point. And so for us, it was about how do we collaborate with the people who are like-minded, and how do we stop those people who are literally, one, ruining a great profession and making us all look bad. I have a great line where I said, we have to get to the point where we police our own. And we're afraid to do that. We're afraid to do that as educators. And I think that's a shame. That's absolutely a shame.
It is. That's, I mean, you're so right on the money with that. That's, you know, and it amazes me. And having taught for as long as I do, you know, it's educators do get afraid. And what they get afraid of is that they isolate themselves, that they're the only one who's thinking this way about this other colleague, or they all do the wink, wink sort of thing. And it drives you nuts. It's like, now, come on, man. You know, yeah. That's not right. And, you know, it's funny when you do have somebody then who points out some of that stuff, then sometimes the rest of them start wondering, are you a little, do you rock the boat too much? And it's like, oh, really? Yeah. You know, come on, man. You know that you're doing the wink, wink thing over to this guy that he, you know, so yeah, it's.
Here's the reality, I think, as educators. Educators will confront parents. We'll confront kids. We'll even confront our administrator as long as two other people come with us. It just seems to be, I know, they're moving packs of treats. But the hardest person to deal with is our peers. You know, and I joke about it, but it's not a joke. It's like, what are we afraid of? Are you afraid they're going to park in your parking spot? Are you afraid they're going to eat your yogurt that has your name on it? No, I think what you're afraid of is they're not going to talk to you. It's like a junior high dance is what we are in education. And to be honest with you, in today's day and age, maybe having a colleague who's negative not talk to me, it might be a perk. You know, I mean, I might be okay with that going, you know, Miss Smith's not going to talk to you for a week. I'd be like, that's okay. I'm going to park in her parking spot and eat her yogurt. We'll call it a day. So I'm okay with that, that professional uncomfortability. I'm okay with policing our own and holding each other accountable. I'm okay with that.
You know, you are so right, because it is that afraid, you know, so many are not okay with that. They're afraid of not being talked to. And it's like, really, you know, I don't care. I'm here for the kids, man. We got, you know, and I'm going to surround myself with that. I teach some classes to prospective teachers and to brand new teachers. All right. And one of the things I talk to them about is make friends with the right people. And you got to pay attention to who those colleagues are in your building, because if you surround yourselves with the ones who are, because I was always the one, and I still am. I tell people, don't listen to the people tell you don't smile till December. There's things you got to put in place in order to have good classroom management. We can work on that. But, you know, this whole don't smile thing, I mean, that the kids would be like, you know, want to duct tape you to the ceiling after a while. And, you know, and it's, but, you know, it's a big part of the problem, though, is when the peers will not say something to somebody else and say, you know, you really need to just move on, man, or get with it and have fun with the kids. So, but, you know, and my favorite section in this book is chapter 5. And chapter 5 is titled Creating the Optimistic Classroom, Building a Relationship Culture. And this statement opens one of the sections. We strongly believe that educators can have knowledge about their students' various backgrounds, styles, and experiential history, but unless they are able to connect with them in a meaningful way, they will never be able to maximize the teaching-learning process. Can you just kind of go into that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that all three of us as authors are really about building connections with kids. You know, I use this example, and I love doing this because when I'm recorded, I think it holds me accountable to these things.
Nice.
And that is,
nice.
I'll go toe-to-toe with any legislator, superintendent, school leader in the fact that if we don't get to the social and emotional and developmental needs of our kids, we're never going to get to that academic. We're just not. And great teachers have known this, that if you have drama going on, you're not getting to algebra. That doesn't matter what curriculum that the publishing companies give us, that's how riveting it is. It doesn't matter. It's when there is a need and a child has a need because of their outside influences, and those outside influences impact us in our classrooms, we have to address those. And we have to figure out how to build those relationships. So one, kids trust us. Two, kids believe that we are there for them. And if you don't do that, you can have the best textbook ever or the best lesson ever, and it still won't make a connection with that kid. And so that is, and it's very difficult because you can't rubric relationships. You can't rubric how a teacher looks at a kid and understands apathy of their life. You know, we have kids that live in atrocious situations, and you wonder why they're not doing their homework. It's like, get real for just a second. One of the things that I have in another book that I talk about is, when you look at a kid and you talk about a kid, I'm tired of just venting about a kid. I really want us to look at them socially, emotionally, developmentally, and then outside influences. I want us to really say that, okay, socially this kid looks like this, academically they look like this, but outside influences have a huge impact in that relationship building and the success of writing any plan, any IEP, any 504, C3PO, R2D2, whatever we're writing on that kid is not gonna work until you say things like, oh, we can't have him take this home every week. The kid lives in a dilapidated house where they're selling drugs in a home, and you want the kid to go home and have a paper signed every week. That ain't gonna happen.
Yeah, you
but
got
yet
that right.
We write plans for that all the time.
Yes. That's
That's not relationship building. Why would you? And then you punish a kid for it. You know, you're like, you're punishing children for things that are uncontrollable. So for us, relationships were about understanding your clientele. And I hate business analogies, but that's a good one. Understand your clientele. Understand your kid. Understand where they're coming from. You know, and maybe you'll know why they're not doing their homework. So. I'm done. I'm going to take the soapbox and get off of it for a minute.
That's okay. That's a great soapbox. But by the way, what book was that from? Which of your books is that from?
Well, it's kind of like a combination. It's from Managing the Madness, and then also Taming the Team is really where it's been. It's in Taming of the Team, and where I talk about when teams talk about a kid and they're trying to solve a problem with a kid, that they actually look at the kid socially, emotionally, developmentally, and then outside influences. So. Because I think that's important. It's about looking at a kid holistically,
oh, yeah.
Not just one vision of the child.
That's excellent. That's I think that's one of the teachers that struggle the most. They lack that understanding of needing to understand that part of kids. And that's what drives me nuts about all the outside influences on education, public education, that want to tell us all kinds of things about that's not real. From focusing on developmentally inappropriate types of skills at different levels to totally ignoring that social emotional, because the social emotional is the part where kids get connected to the school and then start realizing, hey, somebody cares about me and I'm going to work for you, man. And you know, there's a lack of understanding there. So good stuff. I appreciate you talking about that. What I'd like to do before we finish up, I got a last couple of things here. During the presentation, I heard you talk about, and you spent some time on the importance of getting the kids to understand words. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I use the issue around, it's around vocabulary, I think. Is that what it was about?
Yes, it was.
Understanding that words have multiple meanings and multiple subjects.
Yes, and you were getting ready to get into the paper plates. It was right before you did that.
The analogy I give is this, is I said, you know, unfortunately, we can't teach the same way we assess kids in this country, which I think, again, is educational criminality at its finest. Because I almost think that if we could assess and teach kids the same way, I think our kids would do far better. Example that I use is I say,
Wouldn't it be great to walk in on the assessment and say to our students, hey, do you guys remember the Mayans? Do you remember they had a good thing going? And they made mistakes. What did they do to ruin their situation? I think gifted kids can answer that, and I think special ed kids can answer that. I think kids can answer that question. If, again, we've taught that curriculum and we explain that. But what happens is we put that into an assessment question. And the assessment question usually goes like this. It says, civilizations thrive and prosper based on economic decisions. What economic decisions do the Mayans need or did the Mayans make that caused their demise? Well, what's fascinating about that is only one word relates to the content, the word Mayan. The rest is all words. It's all vocabulary. A kid has to know everything from civilization, thrive, prosper, economic decision, demise. You know, it's all about the words. It's not about necessarily the content. And so the example I give is the word relationship. You know, if you're going to use the word relationships in an assessment, and I'm a seventh grade boy, relationships only mean one thing to a seventh grade boy. And so then it's confusing to a kid because it'll say, what is the relationship between these two animals? And you have a kid going, those animals are making out, they're doing it. Because that's how they associate the word relationship. They don't see that it has multiple meanings in multiple subjects. And that's our job as educators, is to say words have different meanings in different subjects. And it really is a sad state of affairs that I'm spending 3 minutes with you on this podcast talking about teaching to a test so that kids can be successful. But if we know that's the barrier, then we have to attack that barrier. And grade schools are doing that with those word walls. But everyone thinks those word walls are just for language arts and for other subjects. I want them in math, PE, language arts, social science, art. I want them in every subject because kids need to see those words that they struggle with in multiple subjects and use multiple times so that they know they have multiple meanings.
I love it. That is so true, because they cannot get the content if they don't spend some time with the academic words. Some adults failed. I don't know if they think they're going to, just because they use them enough that the kids are going to get them, or that they're actually going home and looking them up online.
And most of these assessments are written for middle class America. You know, and I grew up in middle class America, but my mom didn't use a lot of those words. I mean, my mom didn't use the word demise, you know, unless she was like, Jack Charles, stop looking at me on a smack yuck guy demise. But, I know, that's my favorite joke. I love that joke. But, you know, she didn't use those vocab words. And I'm a normal kid. When I was, you know, I was normal. But my mom wasn't using half of those words in my home.
Right,
I mean, come on.
And that's what kills me too, because it's like I'm the same planet with you. As a matter of fact, you know, I love the memory of my parents, but my dad had kind of his own vocabulary.
Exactly.
you know, it's like those are the words, man, that you're counting on. That's not. It was a unique blend of some Italian mixed in there with some, regular English.
Mine was German and Polish.
Nice.
You know, so we'd get dupa, you know, which is backside, which is your dupa, your butt.
Nice.
And so I'd get that a lot. You know, I'm going to, you know, my mom would be like, I'm going to smack your dupa. You know, so I mean, again, I've not seen an assessment that's going to have the word dupa on it. So I guess what
you're calling it. Raise your hand. Teacher, excuse me. Can you explain this word? Because dupa is what I wanted to write dupa, but I.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. Oh, you're right.
Nice. It would probably work the other direction. They'd be asking you, hey, Jack, you want to explain what dupa is? Because we're not
dupa
so sure.
Is, yeah.
Nice. I like that. Now, you've taken over. You're the CEO or of Nuts and Bolts Conference in Destin, Florida. You want to talk about that just a little bit? Now, I know it just happened.
Sure.
So,
yeah, it did. You know, of course, you know, I'm biased because, it's a conference that I bought a couple years ago. And I think it's a special experience, and it's hard to describe. I just sent out a thing to all the attendees, and I said, you know, thank you so much for coming, and you know, we'd love your pictures and your thoughts about the conference, and some of the testimonials from teachers are just amazing, because the conference Ready to Lead, Teach and Learn that I run in Destin, Florida, and I'll be doing one in Colorado this next year. It's not about the current fad in education. It won't be about necessarily differentiation of instruction or whatever is coming down the pike. The conference is really just about quality teaching building relationships with kids and good instruction and classroom management, all of those found a foundational pieces that make teachers great. And that's what the conference is about. And we also celebrate good teaching, and we treat the attendees, I think, just I can't even describe it. We truly just make them feel special. We make them feel grateful for being in education. We don't beat things down with statistics or data, or we don't whip out the PowerPoint and bore them with the data and stuff. We really just talk about what is good teaching, what is it about building relationships with kids, so they go back and can hopefully have that hope and that optimism to be a great teacher. And so it's just I want to say it's a kumbaya kind of conference. It is, with content, with substance, but also with heart and soul and just care and compassion for education. And that's what I wanted the conference to be, and that's why I bought it.
Excellent.
If you want something to look like your vision, then you either manipulate it or you own it. And so now I can do both.
I like that. That's cool. I was going to say, the other day I went out and bought some LPs, some vintage, they're called vintage now, but some record albums, and you go out and buy a conference. I like that. So tell me, now, is it going to be in Destin and in Colorado, or is it just going to Colorado?
Yeah, next year, always in June. We're always in June. And we'll be in Destin the 20th through the 23rd, 24th time period next year. And then we'll be in Denver, Colorado, the 12th and 13th of June.
Oh, excellent.
And so, the conference started here in Colorado. And so I'm hoping to bring it back here to the lovely state of Colorado and bring back that conference, plus the great one that we do down in Destin. It's just quite a great experience. So.
Very cool. You know, being near the beach, it's going to be attraction.
Yeah, right? We're done usually by 2:33, so, try not to compete with the sunshine.
Cool. Awesome. Wish you the best with that. If someone wanted to connect further with you, where would you send them?
Sure. It's real easy. They can just go to jackberkmeyer.com. And actually, all of those, all my handouts are there. They're all free. There's a couple of video segments. Who knows? Maybe even this podcast. You can maybe get on there as well. So, have people be able to link to that and hear this message. So,
that would be awesome.
Very easy. Just jackberkmeyer.com. And, like I said, I'm gearing up for August. August is kind of the back-to-school time where I spend a lot of time doing a lot of opening keynote speeches for K-12 schools, and I love that because it kind of fires people up and gets them ready to go back and do great things for kids.
Excellent. I could see you doing it, too, because after watching you, like I said in my intro, when I said he's funny, that wasn't written for me. That was my experience. You're funny, got me fired up and got me inspired, and it was so exciting. I got last two questions, and these are questions I like to ask my guests. And so the first one is, if you were given the chance to talk with 100 brand new teachers who haven't started teaching yet, what advice would you give them?
Simple. Be committed to the age group you teach. Know where you want to be, and once you make that commitment towards that age group, know the fads, the fashions, the trends, and the slang of your age group. It makes such a huge difference to really know your clientele. It just makes you real, it makes you personable, and makes you make connections with kids and build those relationships.
Excellent advice. Thank you. And the last one is, do you have a teacher in your past who made a difference in your life? And if given the chance to say thank you, who would you say it to, and what would you say?
Absolutely, and they know this. So now I'm going to make them listen to this podcast because they already know this. And so right now, when they're going to get ready to listen to this, they're all going to say, "Oh, I know he's going to say my name." So they know because I tell them all the time what an impact they had on me. Because now we're friends, and we're very close friends, and we care about each other immensely. And that is obviously my love and thanks and appreciation. I would not be the teacher I am today, but easily without Miss Yelico, Miss Fromhart, and Miss Cervantes. And they know this. They know this all the time. And they got to introduce me one time at a speech, and it was funny because one of them couldn't talk. She cried the whole entire time. And they're just, I know how proud they are of me. And that just makes me feel, I can't even use the words, it just makes me, it gives me joy and makes me feel great that they love and care about me so much, and they're just so proud of me. So, and my favorite teacher of all was my dad. So,
He was an amazing man. So is an amazing man. So, and he was definitely a great inspiration to me.
Excellent. Thank you so very much, Jack. Well, Jack, I can't thank you for joining me today. Boy, that didn't come off right. Jack, I can't thank you enough for joining me today. There we go. Let's say that right. You're engaging and inspiring. Yeah, the humor that you use is just right on the money, and you help make us remember that our worlds are funny. I mean, the world of school is a funny place sometimes, but you put it to good use to help us think about how we can be more engaging and more focused on the kids, and it's greatly appreciated. I wish you so much the best, and safe travels.
Thank you so much. I appreciate this time. It was great.
Thanks, Jack. You take care now.
You too.
Hello, listeners. We want to remind everyone to check out all of our digital content at teachinglearningleadingk12.com. That's teachinglearningleadingk12.com. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. Just search Teaching Learning Leading K-12 in the iTunes store. Check back often for updates and new material.
Hang tight, everyone. I'm going to let go of the wall.
You have been listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, recorded in Eastman, Georgia, at the Heart of Georgia Precinct.
Hey, did you know that we're now available on Google Play Music? That's right. You can now find Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 on Google Play Music. Check us out.